To acknowledge our university and community supporters, the University of Iowa's international programs, and the University of Iowa's honors programs. They contribute vital time, talent, and logistics to our organization. I also want to thank the Stanley UI Foundation Support Organization for their financial support, and I thank today's special financial sponsors, Mason K. Braverman and Ed Zastro. It is my pleasure to introduce Mo Shikali. Mo is a junior in the University of Iowa, and he is majoring in evolutionary biology on the prudential track and minoring in international relations. Mo is also an ICFRC intern, which we thank him so much for. Mo is an asylum seeker from Damascus, Syria. He was an immediate activist against the Assad regime at the onset of violence in Syria 5 years ago. At the urging of his parents, he fled Syria, initially to Egypt and then to the United States. Please join me in welcoming Mo Shikali.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking the time out of your day. This is honestly a lot more people than I expected to come. Thank you for my friends for coming. I love the support. This is by far the biggest presentation I've had to make, so I'm pretty nervous, if you can't tell. Like she said, introduced me. My name is Manzer Shikali. I usually go by Mo because I found it a lot easier when I first came here. And I actually, a fun fact, I learned a lot of my English by watching The Simpsons. And Mo Szyslak, the bartender, was one of my favorite characters. So I decided to adapt the name, it fit, and I've been ahead since then. So I moved to the US about 4 years ago. It was actually December 21st, 2012, so it'll be exactly 4 years and 20 days. It doesn't feel that long, but I initially moved to Des Moines because my brother lived in there. He was a doctor. He lived for 5 years at that time, and he had a family and a house, and made sense. I went to Dowling Catholic High School for, I don't know if anyone knows. And then I came here because of the good dental school they had and the scholarships they gave me. This is actually the first picture I took in the United States on day one in Sears Towers, Chicago. It was, remember the first day I came here, I went and bought a really heavy coat because I've never experienced the weather that cold up to that point in my life. And then went and bought Starbucks because that's what America is about. And I just remember how like amazed I was of everything, how tall the buildings were, how clean everything was, how the Christmas lights were like. And I mean, Chicago's skyline is amazing for anyone that comes even from the US. So imagine a 16-year-old that lived his entire life in Syria. It was just a dream coming true for me. And like I said, I'm an intern here for ICFRC. I would usually be at the front desk taking your money. So it's a nice change to stand up. But that's how I initially got to meet Ed and got introduced to him. And I remember him talking to me last summer about speaking. He was asking me if I was interested in such a thing. And I wasn't really sure what I would speak about at that point. I kind of brainstormed. I remember at that point in the summer, and I mean, up to this point, when you hear about Syria, you mainly hear about ISIS and refugees. How many of them, where they're going, how half of them are terrorists or trying to take people's jobs. So I tried to talk about something different, something that people wouldn't necessarily turn on their TV and their news channel would be talking about. I thought about talking about the daily lives in Damascus, the city I grew up in and lived my entire life in, a city that's not like Aleppo, that's being constantly bombed and there's constant fighting, something that's completely different. It's hard to imagine what the daily life in Syria is like. I mean, even for me, I left 4 years and it's hard for me to kind of wrap my head around how life is still going on after 5 years of what's going on. My family is still in Syria, my mom, my dad, my sister, her son, and my brother, along with his wife, and my extended family, aunts and uncles. And people constantly ask me how they're doing. Are they safe? Are they okay? And I don't really know how to answer usually those questions. I mean, yes, they are safe, but safe is a different meaning in Syria. It's not Iowa City safe. It's safe considering the rest of Syria, relatively. But they're not really safe. I mean, how can people really continue their normal lives after 5 years of this kind of violence? Just to show people, this is where Syria is located on the map. I'm sure a lot of people have seen this. This is compared to the neighboring countries, Turkey to the north, Iraq to the east, Jordan south, Lebanon to the west, and Israel and Palestine southwest. And then Damascus, as you can tell, in the southwest area itself. About a couple hour drive from Beirut, Lebanon, a couple hour drive from the Israeli border. So it's a very important, strategically important city. Some background information about Syria. This is a picture of it during the night. It was a beautiful city. I would love to go back one day. Some information about Damascus is it's actually the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. There is some facts dating back to 9000 BC of life there. It's been mentioned in a lot of old scriptures in the Bible and the Quran and Torah, and it's very important historically. The last estimate of the population was in 2009. There was about 1,711,000 people residing in the city of Damascus and the suburbs. At this point, there isn't really any reliable estimates on what the number of people that are still living in there. I personally expect the number to be much higher. Like I said, there's no really real estimate, but based off the information I have, it's much larger, which is unexpected. But what happened was in Damascus specifically, the circle of where the city is have kind of got shrunk to a small radius of about a few kilometers where there isn't constant fighting, where you can continue your daily lives without being bothered. And a lot of people from around the country, from other cities, from the suburbs, from the countryside kind of seek refuge in the area. So you have a lot of people that came into a small area, and Damascus is a small city start with. So this has created a lot of problems, clearly. I mean, people who lived their entire life in Damascus felt like people from other sides of the city were foreigners now, because there was a lot of people in the country, in the city. It's created a lot of problems with jobs, problems that people are afraid of in here because of immigrants. But this obviously created a lot of problems. I'm going to talk about it a little bit, and I'm going to talk about what the daily lives are like in Syria. So this is life in Syria right now in Damascus is rough, to say the least. I don't think there's any better word to describe it. When you leave your home in the morning, you're not really guaranteed coming back. Things like mortar shells and suicide bombs and kidnappings are something of daily lives. The intensity of those things have gone down in the past years, which is a good thing, but they still continue to be a daily life thing that people have to deal with. And that changes kind of how people think, the things that people care about. I remember when, even 2012, before I left, how I was getting into that mentality that I was constantly reminded of my immortality, of the fact that, hey, there's a realistic possibility that you might not come home. And people just, I think, accept that at one point. And it's truly amazing feeling. I don't know if amazing is the right word, but it changes how you think. But this is a picture of my brother's home in Damascus. I don't know if you can really tell, but it's the front side of the house, and the front window is broken. And the story behind this was while my brother was out of the house, we had a family friend and an electrician, which is, by the way, is a booming trade in Damascus. I'll talk about it in a little bit. But he was in the house working on some electrical problems, and a mortar shell actually fell through the front window, and it killed him. And that's something that people have a lot to deal with this year. That's exactly what some people are worried about most of the times. And what's notable to say that a mortar shell and an explosion doesn't necessarily kill people itself. It's the sharpenels that are produced from it. It kills people or permanently disables them or causes serious injuries. So if a mortar shell falls in a highly populated area, you don't have to necessarily have it to be targeted anywhere. The sharpenel is kind of guaranteed to kill a few people. And it's really hard to kind of know who's responsible for those at this point. I mean, it's merely a byproduct of the fighting around the city. A mortar shell isn't really something sophisticated by any means. It's just a throw it in a barrel and it follows a projectile motion. If there's any winds or anything that went wrong, it will fall in the wrong place in a street where there's a lot of people walking. And the person that died wasn't really someone that was involved in anything. He never cared about politics. He was someone that was just a simple man that all he cared about was providing for his family. And that's what the war does. It just destroys the ones that are least involved, I guess. Like I said, the being an electrician is a very profitable job in Syria right now. This is a picture, I can't tell with the lighting very much, but this is a satellite picture during the night of Syria showing the areas that are lit in the country, comparing March 2012 to December 2014. And I don't know if you can tell, but it's shocking the amount of how dark it is. Estimates say that there has been an 83% decrease in energy production since 2011 in Syria. So in Damascus, if you think of a very rich area in the middle of the city, this is call it a spoiled area. Their electricity situation is they don't have electricity for 3 hours, and then they will get it for 3 hours, and it will rotate. This is a very, like I said, spoiled area. So for 12 hours of the day, you don't have electricity. And this is obviously a very frustrating thing for students trying to study, moms trying to cook, store owners trying to keep their dairy products just viable, and people just trying to operate fans in a country where 100 Fahrenheit degrees is not very uncommon. It's very heard of. So what's fascinating to me is that electricians have taken advantage of this, and they've come up with truly innovative and creative solutions. What people do in Damascus is they take a car battery, something that's very, it's designed to discharge and recharge very many times, and it produces large amounts of energy. They take this battery and they connect it to a transistor and a converter. And while the electricity is on, the car battery is being charged. Once the electricity goes off, it will automatically switch and it will start producing the energy to an outlet. And over time, they started maximizing this. They built more battery. They took more batteries. They started using LED lights that will minimize energy use, connected the wires in a certain way that will produce energy in the most maximal efficient way. And at this point, people are just like, when you buy a house, you ask, do you provide this within the house? Like, people building house will build it within the foundations. They will design a room underneath the staircase or something that will be filled with batteries. And it's pretty efficient. I mean, my brother, when I would be talking to my brother, I can, on Viber, if you've ever seen it, it gives you like the internet connection, how good it is. It'll go from good to poor for about 3 seconds and it'll go back to good. And that's how I know that electricity went off. So I think it's pretty creative how people have taken advantage of this. And I think people would truly be impressed with if they were to come here. But what's interesting to me is that most people don't really complain about the death and the bombs and everything like that. People somehow get used to it, like I said. They just expect it and they're fine with it. But what people are always complaining, everyone complains about this in Damascus, is the rising price of everything. Food, transportation, clothes, entertainment, you name it. It's gone up at least 500 or 600%. That's what the inflation rate in Syria right now. Unemployment is about 50%. Extreme poverty is around 80%. People are struggling, 80% of the population is struggling to get food. Can you imagine half of the population isn't working? To put this in perspective, in 2011, $1 was equivalent to 45 Syrian pounds. Now it's 213, and it's usually very unavailable. If you try to look in the black market, it's more like 250. And in Syria, and especially in Damascus, most people are government employees. They receive a monthly salary, and they live off of it. And an average employee is about 10,000 to 15,000 Syrian pounds. So 2011, this was about $323 a month. Now it's about 40 to 75. So you have salaries remaining the same over the 5-year period, while everything else have gone up. Demand has gone up, supply have gone down. My parents say $15,000, if you don't think about rent, you don't think about bills, you don't think about any sort of emergency medical conditions, food and drinks will get you about 2 weeks. They think for the other 2 weeks of the month, people survive on very minimal amounts of food. People rely on relatives outside of Syria sending money back. And I mean, I don't doubt it. I don't think just the math doesn't add up for how people are really surviving at this point. But what's also weird to me is that my parents say everything is available. There's nothing that you can't find. If you want a Twix, if you want a Pepsi, if you want to get the newest movie in the U.S., you can have it as long as you have enough money for it. They say new restaurants and new entertainment centers and new high-end shopping centers are opening at a higher rate than ever before. Like I said, what happened is the circle have gone such a small amount and the people have risen up. That if you have all your assets in the middle of Damascus, if nothing was affected, then you are in a very good shape. But if you had a factory or a shop in another city or in the suburb, then your main source of income has been destroyed. And this is what if you go down, my parents say, if you go downtown, try to eat in a restaurant, you probably won't find a spot. It will take you a couple hours to get seated even. Like I said, most of this problem comes from the fact that a city that was already populated, highly populated, have increased the population, decreased the small size. It created so many different problems, economical, the electricity, another part of why it's going out, regardless of the fact that a lot of the production facilities were affected and a lot of the raw material cannot be transported across the country. It's the fact that the demand for it have gone up much more, that there isn't really a possibility to provide. This is a picture of something, it's called Uptown Cafe. It's a very new amusement park that was built in 2014. Costed $40 million. It's a 15-minute walk from where I used to live in Damascus. It's just a huge entertainment complex that it has everything you can think of, water park, amusement park, hookah bars, nightclubs, restaurants, everything, basketball courts, soccer fields. From the pictures I've seen, we don't really have something like this in Iowa. And this is what it's created. The war have created something like this. 80% of the population is in extreme poverty, and the rest are living lavishly and have extremely profited from what happened. So this is what happened. It's a city filled with contradiction. You have 12-year-old orphans trying to find food for their 8-year-old siblings, while the rest of the population are wondering what nightclub to get drunk at and what bar to spend their money that they've never had before. You have students that are dreaming about going to school that they haven't received an education in years. And that's why I think civil wars are so much harder than any other interstate war. They just destroy the fabric, the basic fabric of society. Even if everything goes back to normal, those people will never grow up. Those kids will not grow up without hatred in their hearts while they're roaming the streets trying to find food, while they look across the street and they see half the people are spending money they've never dreamt of doing. It's just interesting. So another aspect I want to talk about is social changes that are taking place. It's not something that people necessarily think about or talk about, and it's kind of silly to think of, but what happened is in Syria, all the men are gone. I mean, either war, dead, missing, refugees in different countries. And so when you hear, when you listen to people in politics, especially in the last few periods, you hear about how they say, look at Europe, look at the refugees in Europe. They're all men. You don't see kids, you don't see women. What are those men doing in there? Why aren't they going back to their country to fight or help end this, the problem? And to a certain extent, that is true. What happened is the problem is the refugee journey is such a dangerous and rough journey that most people end up either drowning, getting kidnapped and sold as organs in the black market, or end up in a back of a truck. I don't know if you've ever, you have never seen this picture. It's an abandoned refrigerator truck that was found in 2014 on the sides of Austria. It had 71 dead Syrian refugees that were thought to have suffocated. They were trying to go to Germany, the place where it's a safe haven for Syrian people that are trying to go there. I personally have experienced something like this. My brother-in-law is actually in Germany right now as a refugee. He was a chemical engineer in Damascus. He got married to my sister. She's a pharmacist, and they had a kid. And they were fine. They were living their normal lives, getting by. But they felt like there was no future for them. I mean, they were living until they were living, but there wasn't really anything more than that. There was any opportunities that can come out of it. So they tried to go to Europe, to Turkey at the beginning. My dad, my brother, and my brother-in-law, they tried to start a business. And after a little bit, it failed because of the strict laws on Syrians living in Turkey at this point. There's just so many that if you have to open a business, you need to employ 3 Turkish people for every 1 Syrian you employ. And it's just an unsustainable business model that fails unless you have just a huge amount of startup money. So he decided to take the Mediterranean trip to Cyprus at the beginning, and then follow a trail that's constantly changing and at this point isn't really available. But he told us the horrifying stories that the mobs of smugglers, it's you get on a boat, on a rubber boat made for about 6 people, you have 50 people or so on it. You drive half, you're on the sea for half of the way, and then the smuggler will destroy the rubber boat and jump, and another boat of smugglers will pick him up, and the people on the boat will have to swim their way to the other half. If they're lucky, they'll get picked up by the coast guards, and not, they will drown. So that's what happened. Men will try to, they would rather risk their lives rather than their wives and kids' lives. And if they somehow get there, they would, after living for a while and getting some sort of a legal status, they'll try to bring their families there in a much less dangerous way. So what this has created is a country with no men, pretty much. I mean, my parents say for every 10 girls walking down the street, there's a couple guys. And it has very much longer effects than short term. Think of World War II, when men were shipped to Europe and women were faced with jobs that they never had to deal with. They were faced with operating factories, running countries, raising kids without their fathers. And it had much longer lasting effects on that, but at least the men came back. I don't know if that's going to be true in Syria, and I'm not sure if it's going to be. I hope it has such a positive impact. I would like to think that experience in World War II for the U.S. have enabled such movement like the feminist movements, civil rights movements, had at least a role in it, but I don't know if that will be exactly how it will be in Syria. So I'm sure a lot of people are going to ask this, so I'm going to talk about how I think this will end. So from a international relations, international conflict scholarly point of view, the situation in Syria have reached something called a mutually hurting stalemate. Neither side are strong enough to completely win, but they're strong enough to kind of keep enduring a fight and keep hurting the other side to keep the war going. And historically and statistically speaking, after 5 years of a civil conflict that reaches this kind of stalemate, there is close to 0% chance of a decisive victory, military victory, as an end. Which I believe, I think a lot of people have realized this at this point. Neither side are going to win. Add to that the fact that both sides are allied by two very strong coalitions. Add to that the ethnic and religious aspect that the war have taken in Syria. Add to that ISIS and all the strategic aspects of Syria and Damascus, and you have yourself just a complete mess. So for how I think this will end, I honestly have no idea. I think experienced negotiators and diplomats who have worked with things like this in the past and were able to solve stuff that are complicated, people like Akhtar Ebrahimi and Stefan de Mistura, seem to be just frustrated and about to give up. I mean, they reached a wall. Neither side is willing to back down, and neither side are willing to talk to the other. But, well, let me back. So people are going to probably ask me where I'm personally at, a legal point of view at this point. Like I said, I'm an asylum seeker. So 4 years ago, I came in here on a student visa. It's called an F1 visa. It's what most international students come on. All the Asian or the Middle Eastern students on campus are most likely on. It doesn't really provide you with anything other than being able to study. Some cases will allow you to have an employment on campus, but it will just provide you with the ability to stay in the country as long as you are studying. So shortly after I came here, I applied for an asylum before I was 17. And for people, I'm sure not many people are familiar with the asylum process. The way it works is you submit an application. You send in, you go and give your fingerprints, then your fingerprints, your eye prints, your medical records, anything you can think of, pretty much everything. And then you wait. And then after a while, you get a date for an interview with a federal judge. You go to this federal judge and talk about your case, why you think you should be allowed to stay in the United States, what exactly you are afraid of to go back, how you will benefit the American society, what have you been doing up to that interview, just everything you would like to help your case with. And then you go home, and that judge makes a decision, either yes or no, and then your name gets compared to with a bunch of different federal agencies, international agencies, and security agencies that will check your name against a list of blacklists. Like, have you ever committed any violent crimes? Have you ever received any military training? Have you anything? And the process is a very rigorous process. It's not simple. I mean, my lawyer tells me about people, about this case that he had to deal with, where a man from, I can't remember exactly, but it was an African country. His father was kidnapped by some of the militias, a group that was classified as a terrorist organization, according to the United States government. They kidnapped his father, and they wouldn't release him without a ransom. So the man had to deal with them. He negotiated and gave them eventually a ransom. Once they released his father, he escaped here. And once he applied for asylum and he told them what happened, he was actually denied because technically he negotiated with terrorists. And there's many different stories that are almost ridiculous. If you ever kind of try to defend for yourself, you have committed a crime. But you go home and you wait on a piece of mail that says, yes, you are granted asylum. No, you are not. This is how much time you have left in the United States. Please report to your deportation center or legal punishments will take place. There's many ways after that to try to fight it, but once you get no, it's kind of it's a hassle. It's hard to get a yes after that. So where I'm personally, and by the way, if you go on the USCIS website, it's called United States Customs and Immigration Services. It's the agency responsible for any sort of all visas go through it, all the asylum processes go through it. If you go on the website and look at average times of waiting duration between applying and getting an interview and getting a decision, the average time between getting an interview and applying is between 6 months to a year, and then between getting your interview and hearing a decision is 2 months to about 6 months. And by the way, the federal agency is self-funded, almost self-funded. All the money of it comes from applicants' fees. If you want to send in any application. It costs $300 and $400. For to give your fingerprints, it costs you $85 biometric fees. So for people saying that it's costing a lot of taxpayer money, it's just not true. It's self-funded. But for me personally, I applied and I received the interview after 2 years. And then it was actually last year I had the interview and I continued to wait. I have not heard anything, and it's a very frustrating process. It's just me and Sandra were talking a little bit earlier. She was an immigration lawyer, and she decided to stop practicing because of how frustrating this process is, how kind of you're in the dark, really. You don't know. I mean, it's frustrating for me personally because it's not like I'm scared of being deported at any point. I'm living my normal life every day, but it has far more implications. I can't apply to dental schools before I know the answer. Most dental schools don't accept international students. And the ones that do have a very slim number of people they accept. And you can't get loans, you can't get scholarships. It's just a very frustrating process. I mean, if for anyone who goes through a med school or dental school process, you know how frustrating it is with normal situations. So imagine adding a factor that you really can't control whatsoever, but is pretty much the most important factor. And there isn't really any way to find out where the process is at. I mean, even if you call, they refuse to talk to you because of security reasons. Your lawyer doesn't know where it is at, so you're completely in the dark. But what I want to conclude on is that no matter what, how horrible life looks like, everything will be okay. Life keeps going on. People will move on from their lives. People will continue to smile at the end of the day. Humans are extremely adaptive, and they're the most resilient species out there. And no matter what, even death, even this worst situations, people will move on. That's what war does. It exposes societies. It does show the worst, but it also shows the best. It shows how people can unite together and how they can stand together when they don't really have any other choice. I don't really know how the future looks like for the U.S. and for Syria and for me personally, but I'm very optimistic. I don't know what it will look like in a month or two or whatever once Trump takes place, but I'm extremely optimistic. I mean, I have the chance to stand right here and speak to a group of people, and the people that have accepted me in here never made me feel different. I'm a Muslim, and I went to a Catholic high school, Dowling, and I've never felt discriminated against. People were always happy to invite me over to Thanksgiving dinners and Christmas parties just because they weren't really sure what I was going to do at that time. And I think it's really important to kind of point out and talk about those stories because it's usually only the bad stories that will get mentioned. And I think people start to lose faith in their neighbors and other citizens, and I think it's important to just note how nice people are usually, and it's the few people that will kind of, you can notice them more, and they're much louder. But like I said, I'm very optimistic about the future, and everything, I believe everything have worked out for me somehow. I think everything in the end will be good and everything will be okay, and if it's not, then it's not the end yet. Thank you, everyone, and I hope you have a good rest of your day.
All right, so for our first question, what can you say about the role of the U.S. and other developed nations in the economic development in central Damascus and in the growing black market?
The role of the United States, I mean, in any country, you need a lot of foreign investors to make the country work. And that was one of the main, that's always the main problem in a country that's like dealing with conflicts inside of it. There are a lot of the foreign investors pull out, you're dealing with just a crash right away. Luckily, I mean, I don't know if luckily is the word, but there wasn't much foreign investing at the beginning in Syria to start with, especially United States. I mean, there was one KFC in Syria. I remember it was close to my house. But I think there's still some investment in Syria. I mean, I'm sure the the weapon market have gone up, the sales have gone up pretty high. I don't know how, after everything is done, the money for reconstruction, I mean, I think estimates say a few $1 trillion is the cost. I'm not really sure where that money is coming from. I mean, all the embargo on the government is making it even worse. I completely disagree with governments imposing embargoes on governments, because really the people that are affected, it's never really the government. But the growing black market is, I don't know how to describe it, but I don't think people have understand how big the black market is. It's not just dollars, and it's not just food, and even food is sold in the black markets in areas that are that food isn't going into. You have black markets for organs. You have black markets for sex slavery, I'm sure. You have for oil. You have black market for even old artifacts. Everything is being, I mean, that was the main problem in the Egyptian Revolution. They had a lot of the museums being stolen and all the artifacts sold in the black market. So I don't think the developed countries have a role. I don't think they're really concerned with black markets unless they involve selling of weapons. But that's my opinion on the involvement. It's definitely very devastating to have foreign investors pull out, but there wasn't many Western investors to start off with in Syria at that time.
What can we in Iowa City do to help?
That's a good question. I mean, something like this, I guess, would help to start with. I think change happens at a small time. I don't know if you remember when Janine DiGiovanni came and spoke about how even small voices will eventually be heard. I think unity and talking about the problem is talking about how it's not just people are dealing with death. There's many things. People can relate to not having electricity for 12 hours a day. You can definitely relate to what that would be. I think it's sympathy more than anything for people who don't really understand. I think just pointing at someone, telling them you're wrong because you don't want immigrants in here, you're wrong because whatever, that just never works. I mean, from your personal experience, when does that work ever? I think talking to people and telling them how we're not different. I mean, I went to Catholic high school, and all the things I learned about Christianity was that 90% of it is exactly the same as Islam. They're same stories, same ideas. Be good to your neighbor, don't steal. So I think just being open and encouraging, talking about it's just don't let it die. I mean, don't let people be left. I think that's the only thing you can do. Write to your representatives. I mean, that's the beauty of being in this country. You can talk to the people you've elected.
Where did you learn your English, and do you have any problems finding areas for your daily prayer?
I'm sure the second question is part of what happened in Ohio State, but I learned a lot of my English, like I said, Simpsons. I think watching TV shows and movies is a great way to learn the language. And advice for anyone that is planning on going abroad to try to study abroad is immerse yourself in the culture. Don't go to areas where, like, I see a mistake a lot of people do is they go to Barcelona and sign up for an American college with easy classes and try to party, which is fine. I mean, it's fun. You'll have fun memories, but you won't have the experience that will actually grow who you are and force you to be more knowledgeable of the language. I think associate yourself from the people who are speaking the same language. That's what you are going to be doing for the rest of your life, and have force yourself to see the culture. I think it's different. Learning a language through a textbook is completely different than going and actually living in that country. I think TV shows and movies will help you very much. Areas on campus to pray. I'm not very practicing personally, but I think I don't really know if there's any areas on campus to pray for Muslims. I feel like it's pretty small campus. If you want to, you can go home. I'm sure if you can find an area, if you were to ask a teacher if he would allow you to start to pray for 10 minutes in their office, they wouldn't really care that much. I'm not really sure, to be completely honest. Maybe I should look into it.
Yeah.
How often do you get to talk to your family? How are they surviving? Are any of them able to work?
I try to talk to my family every day. It's harder. I mean, I have school, and the time difference, I only really get to talk to them around this time, from 1 to 3. It's like an 8-hour difference. They are surviving very well. They're very, like I said, they're in the middle of Damascus, so they are surviving better than others. And like I said, that's exactly what I was talking about them about yesterday. They were saying, no matter what, life keeps going on. They're happy that I'm here and in a better position that I would be in Syria. They're kind of concerned. At that point, they're morally concerned about what's going on with my sister and my brother. They want them to kind of leave. They feel like they've lived enough to kind of just want us to have the more perfect life. And they continue. My dad is almost 65, I believe, and he continues to work because he wants to provide for us. So I can't appreciate anything more than that.
Fit. Where do the Alawites sit?
Alawites.
My apologies. Fit into Islam.
If you're familiar with Islam, there is. It's divided a lot, and every time you go into another divide, there's more divides. There you start with Sunnis and Shia, and then in Shia there's Alawites, and I don't even know how many different provisions. And then in Sunnis there's four different. I don't even know what they're called in English, but I refuse to identify myself as Sunni or Shia or Alawite. I think it's just ways to further divide people. It's Sunni and Shia. The main problem started 1400 years ago over who was the leader of the country. I think it's a very stupid argument, and people need to move on and live in the present. Where do Alawites fit in Islam? They are part of Islam. They believe in what they believe. They are a large group of people in Syria, and they should have their rights just like any other ethnicity in the country. I refuse to say I'm Sunni or Shia, and I think that's what divides people more, because the similarities are far more than any sort of the differences. It's just silly.
I want to thank everyone for coming, and especially I want to thank Mo as well for his wonderful talk. On behalf of the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council, please give a big thank you to Mo Shekali. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. I also thank our sponsors, the University of Iowa Honors Program and International Program, and the Stanley U of I Foundation Support Organization for their generous support. And we also thank today's special sponsors, Mace and Kay Braverman and Ed Zastro. And we thank City Channel 4 for making our programs available for viewing audiences. Mo, as a small token of our appreciation, you know what's coming. We present you with the highly coveted Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's mug. Thank you for joining us. We are adjourned today.